Okay, item number 18, 2012 Puget Sound crab season results, management and enforcement briefing. Rich Childers, welcome. Long time no see. And Mike Sensi, deputy chief.
Thank you and good afternoon, Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director Anderson, and Deputy Director Storr. For the record, my name is Rich Childers. I'm the Fish Program and the Puget Sound Shellfish Manager, and I will be presenting this presentation with my colleague, Mike Sensi, who's Deputy Chief of Enforcement. I will be covering the management aspect of this briefing, and Mr. Sensi will be covering the enforcement piece near the end. And this is our second presentation of this sort to the Commission, and it is a directive in the Commission's Puget Sound crab policy that was adopted in 2010. And it's the way I view it is somewhat of our report card on the performance of the fishery and our compliance rates that we're seeing with regulation and compliance and so forth. And that's what we're going to be covering in the presentation. So kind of quickly, the outline is we'll briefly speak to some of the key elements of the Puget Sound crab policy, and that policy is C-3609, and again, that policy was revised and adopted in 2010. I will speak to the performance of the harvest in 2012 for both the commercial and the recreational fishery. And then a little bit about our education and outreach program that we continued in 2012, which we initiated in 2011. And then the compliance piece that I will speak a little bit to from what we did through some Creel effort, and then Deputy Chief Sensi will speak to the enforcement part on the compliance. So the policy, as I stated, was revised and adopted in 2010. It was a nine-month-long process with a lot of public input, but we got through that in October 1, 2010. It does have conservation and protection measures in the policy that we adopt through regulations that are continue to be in place, and it does provide for both recreational and commercial fisheries for both state fisheries. One of the key elements in the policy is that it maintains a base recreational fishery from year to year with a emphasis on a summer recreational fishery. And that is described and outlined in the policy as a July through Labor Day fishery at 5 days per week, including weekends. So it's a Thursday through Monday fishery, and it's closed 2 days a week on Tuesday and Wednesday of each week. And then depending on what's remaining on the state share in each marine area, there's also a winter opportunity that would be in October through December 31st, depending on if there's quota remaining. And also the commercial fisheries are also dependent on how much quota is remaining in an area. If there's only enough quota remaining for a winter recreational fishery, then the priority goes to the recreational fishery and there's no commercial opportunity. It all in the policy, there's also language that we develop and implement and maintain a education and outreach program. That's a cooperative effort through constituent groups and recreational fishing organizations, which we have continued through 2012. So this is a transition now into our performance of our fishery. And this is, again, kind of a report card of our recreational catch card statistics. And as you can see, the numbers there, we started in 2007, where we have both a summer and a winter catch record card. And the number of catch record card issues or fishers is maintained at around 200 to 230,000 fishers. That hasn't changed. And then we also implemented the reporting on the internet at the end of the summer season and the end of the winter season. And our reporting rate for the summer fishery is still, I'll say it's somewhat stuck or still maintained right around that 50-53% rate, and we're still working to try to get that a bit higher. In fact, I met yesterday with our recreational advisory group, which is somewhat of our steering committee and our education and outreach, and we had a discussion on, well, if we had a goal on what kind of return rate we'd like to see, what would that goal be? And we kind of agreed it'd be 70-75% is kind of where what we'd like to see. We'd like to see 100%, but we know that's not realistic. The winter fishery, a bit better because kind of the pros are out there, and we're seeing, you know, above 60%. We got 65% the last 2 years. On return rates for the winter cards. And you'll notice the last two couple of years, the number of winter cards really dropped down, and that's because we implemented a program where the summer cards are issued automatically in the summer. But if an angler wants to go for the winter, they have to go back to a vendor or contact the department to actually request a winter catch card. And that's to not put the burden of returning that catch card on fishers that generally don't go in the winter. So it's a much smaller user group in the winter, and again, kind of the more rural-aware group, and we get a higher return rate. Something that we've been digging into as part of our education and outreach program, we're kind of looking at who, you know, the demographic of this user group. And this is some new information that we did not present last year. But we started looking at the last few years, starting in 2010, out of all the crab endorsements issued in a year, how many of them are, quote, new fishers. And we defined new fishers as we went back into the database and said, have they got a crab endorsement from 2004 to current. And in 2004 is when we really started that crab endorsement, a separate license and so forth for crab. And we were surprised at how many new recreational crabbers there are each year. You can see the numbers, 70,000, 82,000, 57,000. So those are crabbers that, again, haven't participated in the fishery at least since 2004. So it's pretty close to the same number that are dropping out each year, because the total number of catch record cards or endorsements is staying relatively stable. So that was kind of a surprising number that we're getting this 30% or so turnover every single year of new fishers coming in and the same number kind of dropping out. And we had a long discussion on this yesterday at our advisory group, and we're really going to try to target our education and outreach on those folks starting in 2013, these new fishers that may not be aware of the rules and regulations.
Commissioner Smith has a question.
Just a quick question, Rich. Do you have demographic data on who these new folks are, or entry folks are into it?
Yes, we have a lot of information. In fact, yesterday when we were discussing this, one of the things that came up, and I don't know if I have it in the data sets that have been provided me from the catch card unit, but one of the things we're wondering is how many of those are out of state that are coming in, and they're kind of that first-time crabber, then they don't come back. So we suspect a lot of these, they could be the temporary licenses or out-of-state, the three-day permits and so forth. But we have all the information, their address, where they are, where they live, the counties and so forth.
Of age?
Age, yes.
Do you know off the top of your head?
I do not.
Okay.
But we have that information, and that's, again, before this next, we're going to start digging into that a little bit more to look at the demographics.
Thank you.
Sh- Shifting to the commercial fishery now, by way of review, the commercial permits for Puget Sound has been a limited entry since 1981, and it was limited to 250 permits, and there's 249 of those permits that are active. One of the permits dropped out a number of years ago. It was never renewed, and it just kind of fizzled away. So there's basically 249 transferable active permits. And what this shows is how many of those licenses are owned by one individual, or excuse me, how many individuals own one license, how many own two licenses, three licenses, and greater than four. So example, 86 individuals own one permit, and 45 individuals own two permits for a total of 90. In the greater than four permits, eight individuals own more than four permits. And that is a typo in that column, that should be 61, not 461.
My math, thank you.
And I just caught that 15 minutes before I got up here. So, yeah, that's 61. So 61 of those licenses are owned by eight individuals. And there is one company up in the Bellingham area that continues to grow. That company now owns 27 permits by one owner, and they lease those permits out. So this table just kind of shows where, and I put the regions in there because we kind of crab, we kind of go back and forth between marine areas and regions. So I have this map as a reference. So if you, for instance, in Region 1, which is the North Sound area or Marine Area 7, we did have recreational summer seasons in all areas throughout Puget Sound. We had winter recreational crab seasons in most areas except for Region 4, which is the Seattle area, and Region 6, which is the South Sound area or Marine Area 11. And in both of those areas, the recreational fishery exceeded the state share in the summer fishery, so we had to close it for the winter. And then we negotiated with the tribes a fish-to-equity provisions where the tribes reopen and fish to match what the recreational fishery had taken. So we kind of start the slates clean coming in at 2013. This shows kind of the historical harvest for both the state fishery and the state fishery total, so that'd be commercial and recreational, and the treaty fishery, and then the total of the treaty and the state combined. And as we discussed last year, the 2011 harvest was a all-time record of harvest, and this year we did drop back down to more of a normal about 9 million pound year for Puget Sound, which is still above the last couple of years, but less than it was in 2011. This graph that was created for 2012, this line is still preliminary because we just finished up our last closure of a commercial fishery on April 9th, and there's still a treaty fishery open in the North Sound till the 15th. So the numbers will change a little bit, but by and large, it's probably 98 or so percent of the catches now is what you're seeing here. This is the same graph, but it breaks it down by just the state fisheries, the commercial and the recreational. So you can see, again, we had a drop in both of those fisheries from 2011, but still kind of more in the norm. And the commercial fishery is about 2.2 million pounds, and recreational fishery just about 2.1 million pounds. And this shows where those pounds are caught. Again, Region 1, the North Sound area, Marine Area 7, the bulk of the commercial fishery comes out of that area, that region, with about 500,000 pounds to the recreational fishery. And then in the South Sound areas, Regions 4, 5, 6, and 7, those are all recreational only. There's no commercial fishing allowed by policy in those areas. This is the ex-vessel value adjusted for 2012 dollars since 1991. And again, you can see where in 2011, that was kind of an all-time record for the commercial fishery, fueled by two things. Number one, the high amount of catch, as well as the high price. They're still seeing the price is still very robust in Puget Sound, but it did tick down a bit in 2012 because of the lower catch overall. But this graph was intended to compare the performance of the fishery before the policy was revised in 2010 and then after. So far the last 2 years, even though there was a bit of loss of opportunity to the commercial fishery, the ex-vessel value continues to be above historic levels. So now we're going to switch into our enforcement and education and outreach efforts.
Hang on. Director Anderson?
Thanks. The slide that depicted the ownership and number of permits owned by individuals, most of the limited entry programs I've been involved in have had safeguards against accumulation of the fishery into one hand or another, one company, one individual, whereas we have no, it doesn't appear we have any such protections in this fishery. And I'm wondering at what point do we start ringing the alarm bell that the accumulation of the control of the fishery gets into a smaller and smaller number of hands, and into this, in this particular case where we have individuals or companies that are owning pretty significant portion of the permits, understanding that that would take legislative action to address that problem. But are those concerns being expressed by the commercial fishers at all?
Yes, they are. And the threshold seemed to have been a few years ago when the company exceeded 20 permits. And this is a concern that has been voiced. I haven't heard it in recent months or years. But yes, it is a concern. And you're correct, Director Anderson, it would take legislative change. And right now, the way it is, there isn't a limit on how many permits you can own, as you stated, and there's provisions to lease those permits by having alternate operators. So that's kind of what we're up against. There's two things that I've been discussing with the commercial industry, and that is this issue, as well as maybe implementing, similar to what we have in the urchin and cucumber dive fisheries, a buy-down program, because they have somewhat of a goal or an idea that they would like to reduce this number of permits from 249 to maybe somewhere around 175 or 180 through a self-imposed tax similar. So we are having those discussions, and they're kind of ongoing.
Thanks.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Rich, how many, or if any, are owned by non-Washington residents? And how many of them have the license but aren't operators? They mainly in the middleman and sublease it?
As far as I know, all the permits right now are owned by Washington residents. And I haven't looked in a year or so, but when we looked at that back in 2010, they were Washington residents, all the permit holders. And the bulk of these, I don't know the exact number, but I would guess probably 95% or so of these are fished by the owners, 90% or so, with the exception of that company that owns 27 that are leasing all of them. And in fact, there was just some legislation that looks like it's going to pass that's allowing fishers to stack more, rather than two permits on one vessel, they could stack three. So those that own three permits or four would be able to fish all of them off a single vessel.
Rich, can you tell us a little bit more about the price fluctuations? You mentioned that the harvest had gone up 2011, and that accounted for the ex-vessel value jump. And then you mentioned something about the price coming down.
I may have said price. If I did, I misspoke. The reason that we see that downtick in 2012 is because of reduction in catch and quota. The price has stayed up. It's averaging about $3.63 a pound this year. They've seen it go as high as $5.50 and down as low as $3, but it's pretty stable at, you know, $3.50 to $4 a pound.
And what about, say, 10, 15 years ago? What kind of price were you seeing?
$1.75 or so. Oh,
okay. Yeah. So it's really gone up quite a bit.
Yeah. And Director Anderson can speak probably better about the coastal fishery, but Puget Sound and the coast tend to diverge and differ in that most of the Puget Sound crab is going to live markets. There's little to no processing and pick out, and the bulk of that even is going overseas. China is still a very robust market for live crab, so they air freight them.
Okay. The Chinese demand has accounted for rises in various commodity prices, so wouldn't be surprising in this one, too. Commissioner Mencken.
Rich, do you have any idea what percentage of the crabs are being shipped offshore?
We, during the policy review, we tried to tackle that, and we did that through just some interviews of the top 10, I believe it was, buyers. And we generated a number then of what we estimate how much was actually staying in state and then how much was being exported out of state but within the United States and then how much was actually going overseas. I can't remember what the number, it seems like it was around 50% or so, and I'd have to go back and look at what we provided during the policy review, but it was a substantial amount that was going to China, and then to a lesser degree, New York City and Chicago are very big, and San Francisco are very big purchasers of crab, much more than Seattle, oddly. But since then, we've tried to tackle this through different means of getting a real, and it's other than the freight bills at the airports and so forth, which Deputy Chief Sensi can speak to that one, how that's a forensic accountant responsibility. We haven't been able to really get a good clearinghouse of how much and an exact number of how much of this is actually, you know, because it's sold second and third hand. We get very accurate through the fish ticket system and so forth, but once it's sold and then it's resold and shipped out, it's very hard to track exactly how much of that is going out of the country.
I recall you telling us 60%.
Yeah.
Commissioner Perry?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of a biological question, I guess. It appears that since about 1996, the amount of crab being caught has just increased like mad. Yeah, that, and it's maintained at an extremely high level. At least it looks like from a biomass standpoint, the amount of actual crab taken out of the water is just an amazing amount. What's supporting this high population, and is there a danger of it crashing? It doesn't seem like this is a natural function of a wildlife population.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of discussion and debate on what is fueling this high level of abundance, not just in crab, but we're seeing the same thing in spot prawns.
Yeah.
So there seems to be something environmentally favoring survival of spot prawns and Dungeness crab. There's discussions and theories about, well, as the bottom draggers were limited in Puget Sound, and there's very little trawling that goes on anymore, that may have been killing a lot of crab. There's discussions that, well, there's some of the predator species, like rockfish, have been knocked down that prey on the juveniles. Their numbers are down, so is that what is fueling this 5 years later, these adult populations that are very high? The bottom line is we really don't know exactly, but whatever is fueling it seems to be holding up, because we see these high numbers, this 9 million pounds, 10 million pounds, and we go out and test fish pre-season, and we're seeing the numbers just continue to be robust. And in fact, some areas like Hood Canal, I was last year, hit a record harvest in Hood Canal, over 700,000 pounds.
Jeez.
And so we do set the quotas that are based on the average of the previous 3 to 5 years is what we do as a starting point, but we kind of ground truth that through some test fisheries pre-season, and then we start looking at the catch. So we have provisions to adjust quotas up or down in season, but the adjusting them down, in my memory, has only happened once. Usually it goes the other way. We have a season, the quotas are taken, and we're still seeing very good catches in the fishery. And we're only targeting, I want to remind the commission, only targeting large adult males only, 6 1/4 inches or larger. No females, no sublegal males smaller than 6 1/4. So they've had 1 and sometimes 2 years of mating opportunity before they become susceptible to the fishery.
Thank you.
Commissioner Mencken?
Rich, is the trend line for the coastal stocks similar to this?
I will defer that to Director Anderson.
I haven't looked at the numbers for quite a while, but like years, but this year we're at 17 million pounds so far. We had about a 30-year average of about 8.5 to 9 million pounds. The time frame from 2005 through present day, we've seen some years that are closer to record years, like up in the teens and even at 21, 22 million pounds, with the exception of last year. And last year was more, I don't write this down, but it was down in the neighborhood of 10 million pounds instead of the 17 we saw this year. So, and of course, well, I don't know about of course, but the other thing to consider here is the question has always been in my mind is pre-Rafiti, so pre, really, 95, Rafiti decision of December of 94, were we really fishing the entire area where crab availability was present in Puget Sound when we had the introduction of a new commercial fleet, that being the tribes? Did our commercial fishers, and theirs for that matter, expand the area in which they're fishing crab from what they used to do? So how comparable are these numbers in terms of the effort, the fishing effort, on the total crab grounds in Puget Sound that I believe to be occurring now versus what it was pre-Rafiti? So is this, there may be a couple of things going on here in terms of increased number of crab, the population increases. It may also be that we weren't fully exploiting the resource to the extent that we are now by virtue of the fact that our commercial fishers weren't having to fish in the places that they're having to fish now. Whereas in the coast, the fishery, in my view, was fully exploited. Matter of fact, the commission put a pot limit on around 1999, and we think we reduced the number of pots that were being deployed a year, and from like 130,000 down to around, I think the number's around 80,000. So, anyway, but there are some differences, but I guess the long answer to a short question was no, not really. We've seen more fluctuations in the coast, but if you look over 30 years, the number of years that are in the upper end of the total harvest are far greater in the last 10 years than they were in the first 20 years of that time frame.
Okay, interesting.
So I mentioned, I'll just pause here again for a second, the Hood Canal, which is Region 5, had a very good year this year, and this is just showing the state fishery, the recreational, which caught about 340,000 pounds, and the treaty fishery caught 390,000 pounds. So very good year, and we're running test fisheries again starting next week in that area, but the tribes went out and collected some crab, and it seems like there's, from what I heard, there's the catch rates are even higher this year than last year. So from a recreational fishery standpoint, very popular in Hood Canal right now. So moving into the second phase of the presentation, the looking at the compliance rate in the fishery, and this was something that was discussed quite extensively during the policy review time period, and we committed to not only implementing a pretty robust education and outreach program, but also starting to collect more information on what the compliance rate is in the recreational fishery. With a long-term goal, of course, of improving regulation compliance in the recreational fishery. And we developed a know before you go kind of message with our steering committee that we formed with the recreational advisors and so forth, and really tried to get that message out there on how to measure crab, what the why there's a catch record card, how to fill a catch record card out, and so forth. So we did form a partnership with a variety of groups that continue, and we are expanding. The fish managers, fish program partnering with enforcement is a big part of that partnership. We do a lot of work with enforcement during the summer, July and August, when we have that 200,000 plus crabbers out there. Puget Sound Anglers, another group that we work very closely with, and the Coastal Conservation Association, the Northwest Marine Trades Association, Recreational Crab Fishery Advisory Group, and this year we also partnered with Washington State University Beach Watchers Program and funded some of their work to assist us in some of the dockside education program, and I'll speak a little bit more to that. And through that Washington State University Beach Watchers, there were 7 county marine resource committees that were also pulled into the mix in 2012. So there's a couple of areas that we focus on, and then of course there's the conservation violation, which is a possession of undersized or female crab, and the use of rock cord, two areas that we saw that there was some real need for improvement. And then there's the allocation violations, which are exceeding the daily limit and fail to record and report catch. And the fail to record is that piece that we're still working on, and the fail to report, which is return the card. And that's a big challenge. It's going to take us some time, but we are making some headway in that. And then, the other one is the closed season crabbing. We have that summer fishery that's closed on Tuesday and Wednesday, which means all gear comes out of the water. You can't leave it in. And so we put, through the enforcement program, a lot of emphasis in closed season crabbing the last 2 years. And Deputy Chief will speak to that. So we continue to produce the crabbing in Puget Sound brochure. I think you may have one of those as a handout. And we expanded, not only did we produce that brochure, we've now made it available at all the top vendors. So they have it at the vending site so fishers can pick that up when they buy a crab license. But we also distribute that to every household that purchases a crab endorsement along with a cover memo before the season starts. So we pull around right before July, we print these with a cover memo, and it's an introduction saying, yeah, we see that you purchased an endorsement. Please review this, become familiar with the rules, and so forth. We also produced 25,000 additional waterproof regulation reference cards. I think you have one of those. Those are the ones that you can actually, they're waterproof paper, a form of plastic. You can keep them on the boat. They're very durable, and they have the key elements for the compliance regulations that we're trying to get to, how to measure a crab, how to identify a male and female, and so forth. There was also, we released $46,000 of crab endorsement money to the Beach Watchers program to assist us with the education and outreach program. We'll probably continue that this year. They've got a few modifications, and they put another grant proposal forward. I think they do really good work, and it's supported by our steering committee, so we're probably going to continue to work with them. With the Beach Watchers, who coordinate all the Marine Resource Committee activities. So these are just some of the big events that we target through our education outreach, all the boat shows, and we do, of course, radio coverage and newspaper articles and so forth before the season. We do a lot of offload site crab fisher interviews, and I'm going to speak more to that in a moment. As well as the enforcement emphasis patrols, primarily in July and August. We do have a very good website link specific to Puget Sound crab, a lot of good information on that. And then we also send every household that has a crab endorsement a reminder postcard right at the end of the season, be it the summer season or winter, reminding them it's time to report, and it has a website on it and so forth. So we're not relying on the fishers to actually remember they have to report. We remind them. So the big message there is, as long as we have a current mailing address, you will get a little postcard saying time to report. Log on, and that's been very successful, I think, particularly with the internet reporting, and that's where we're getting the bulk of our reports right now. And the internet reports, I should mention, you cannot do those from memory. You have to have the catch cards in front of you, or if you memorized your 14-digit serial number on your catch card, I suppose you could do it from memory. But basically, to get into the site, you have to type in that serial number on that catch card. So for us, that's verifying that they have it in front of them and they're actually typing in the catch right off the card. A few things about the Beach Watchers program. They did produce this very nice poster. It's about a 2.5 feet by 3 feet poster that they take around to a lot of different venues. And it not only focuses on the regulation compliance, but they have a really good focus program on the use of rock cord. And their overall goal was to educate fishers on conservation-oriented crabbing rules and methods with a focus of reducing gear loss and the use of rock cord. They did coordinate through 8 county marine resource committees. They provided training and coordination to 71 volunteers throughout the summer. They assembled 12,000 of these crabber packets that have rock cord in them, the brochure, calipers, everything you need to know about crabbing, and they contacted 19,700 anglers last summer. Yeah, big number. Very successful. So what we did as staff, what we did, non-enforcement staff, fish program, we continue to do our offload site surveys, if you will, somewhat of a creel survey, checking crab and just looking at catch record cards to see if people are aware of how to fill them out, did they fill them out correctly, and so forth. This year, we kind of changed from 2011, where we actually divided the offload sites that we're going to survey into high use, medium use, and low use, and there was somewhat of a systematic assignment of when the staff would be there, and it wasn't random, it was more systematic than a random survey. And it was, for instance, they would go there, they would interview 12 anglers, successful anglers with crab, or 2 hours, whichever comes first, and they would move to another site and so forth. We're still wondering about more of a random sample, so we're in discussions right now with our advisory group and looking at taking the same number of offload sites and same, but actually truly trying to do a random survey to ground truth what we've seen the last couple of years. So we'd randomize the dates and times when staff would be there. We probably won't get as many contacts. But that's kind of what we're looking at as a change in 2013, to truly try to get a random survey from some of these sites. The goal that we had was collect CRC compliance data after the crab trips are completed. So if someone comes in and they're not done for the day, we don't interview them. It's only when they're done for the day, which is different from what the deputy chief will describe, which they're intercepting people primarily on the water mid-trip. 32 launch sites were surveyed between July 1 and September 30th. For a total of 179 surveys were conducted at these sites. 1,343 crabbers interviewed and 1,203 successful crabbers were interviewed. And staff measured 4,644 crab for legal size. This summarizes what we saw at the offload sites. These are successful crabbers only, and you can see for the last 3 years as a comparison. The possession of undersized crab ticked up a couple of percent, but still not a huge problem. We'd like to get that down, though, to more like 1 or 2%. We have made progress since 2010, when we saw 10% of the crab in possession were undersized. Possession of female crab, not really a problem. As you can see, less than 0.5% across the board. Exceeding limits, also pretty low, at least at the end of the day when they're done. Cash record card in possession, also very good, 97-98%. One area we still got to do some work on is that last row at the bottom, the fail to record. So we're still seeing 12% or so of fishers at the end of the day. They have nice crab, they're legal, they have catch cards, they show the cards, and the crab haven't been recorded. Now, interesting on that, what we see is they quite often have previous trips recorded. So I'm not really sure in the fisher's mind what they're thinking when they get home or after they cook them up or something, but the record immediately on the water, we still got to drive that message home. We're not quite there yet. I'm going to turn this over now to Deputy Chief Cincy, who's going to talk about similar information
but from the enforcement perspective.
Madam Chair, well, as you can see, we made a significant investment in enforcement presence with 36 officers involved in patrols throughout Puget Sound. You can see that we checked more people last year than we did in the previous 2 years. And by focusing our effort primarily on those still engaged in fishing instead of when they're done, we think we have an opportunity to minimize the violations before they occur, or at least limit the amount of abuse. So it's a good approach. It requires more effort to pull enough people together to go on a boat patrol versus hanging out dockside, but we think that it's a good approach. You get a slightly different view of compliance where you have an officer involved versus a sampler where the submission of your catch and record card are voluntary. We don't give folks the option. You'll see I think the uptick with respect to our numbers The reason for that is based on the fact that it isn't voluntary, and we're pretty intrusive in our inspections. So you're gonna detect violations that are intentional and not just open to view. And like I said, we dig pretty deep. We're also contacting people that still might do the right thing, as Mr. Childers represented. We're enforcing the law in the strict sense, which with respect to accounting for your catch says you have to immediately record it. So if you've harvested two legal crab before you pull your next crab pot to get your remaining three, you need to account for those. And if you didn't, then we check the box, the violation box. It may not necessarily get a notice of infraction. However, we do, for statistical purposes and in measuring compliance, enforce the law in its strictest sense. We do believe that some proportion of that 20% is accounting for their catch when they get back to the dock. I mean, you can see, compared to the sample side enforcement, 3% difference with respect to undersized crab from the law enforcement view, 5/10 of a percent in the negative with respect to female possession, 1.5% difference in over limits. CRC card in possession is consistent with what they're seeing at the dock. And then you've got an 8% difference with respect to failing to record. And even if you use our numbers as sort of the true value, the true picture, and I don't like to call it a compliance rate. It's more of a contact to violation ratio, if you will. There's nothing random. It's not as random as we would like. Because some people attract attention. But it's better in 2012 than it was in 2010. I mean, that's pretty significant from my perspective. The level of cooperation that we have with Mr. Childers and the folks that manage this fishery, it's just second to none. It's nothing short of excellent. And bringing better compliance to this fishery has truly been an effort. And I just wanted to take a moment to say that this is one of the most collaborative areas for us, where we partner with our resource managers. And when you think about our work in keeping crab pots out of the water during those closed days or after the season ended, it's a big job. It really is. And it's an area that requires some improvement. But we're working it on together. They've provided a fish program, Mr. Childers, have provided our law enforcement program some additional funds so we can spend additional time on the water, ensuring that not only it's an orderly fishery, but also that this gear doesn't become part of the derelict gear problem in the long run. This is something that can just simply get out of control really quick for us. So, the funding's been increased over the past two seasons. I'm always coming back for more money, seems like. And then Rich is going to get it out of me in the new Port Townsend office. But it enables us to expand our efforts to more Puget Sound than what we had done in the past. I mean, our preference is to do an entire area sweep instead of having to be selective. And the positive effect that this effort has on the derelict gear problem, I don't know how you I don't know how you measure that, but I think it's one of those obvious things. It's got to really help. It's got to help. So this is all about getting it out of the water before it becomes derelict. I mean, I think the contributing factors with respect to derelict gear, I wanted to spend a little bit of time here, are pretty obvious. You've got lost or abandoned gear. You do have close-season poaching. You know, and the techniques that these folks use oftentimes are related to setting longline gear, so there are no surface buoys. They use GPSs to locate the gear that they've marked, and then grappling hooks in order to retrieve it. And even the bad guys lose track of where they put their stuff. And so a lot of that becomes derelict as well. Foreign fishing incursions continue to be a problem. And in fact, they will use that same technique in the Boundary Bay area to avoid detection, and our grappling hooks seem to retrieve quite a bit of gear that shouldn't be there in the first place at all times of the year. And then, you know, gear that's not properly rigged with respect to escape mechanisms, rod cord, escape rings, that's a problem. We all know that that has the potential to continue to kill natural resources indiscriminately. So here's a snapshot of a summary of what we accomplished over the last 2 years. We invested more time in 2012, only two more days, but retrieved a few fewer crab pots by 300 or so, but still a lot of effort. That's a lot of gear. 44 patrol days invested in making sure that our waterways were clear of gear when it shouldn't be there. I think you've heard me speak before that I sort of classify violators in three different categories. You have non-compliant person, easy uneducated. That person is confused. I think that class of individuals is responsible for most of our problems in this fishery, and Mr. Childers and the partnerships with the other organizations and other folks that consumptively use our natural resources, that's helping. I know it's helping. We see the outreach material on the vessels when we contact people. They seem to be much more educated than they were 2, 3, and especially 4 years ago. We saw a really alarming compliance picture 4 years ago. So those efforts, no doubt, have paid off. And then the opportunists, you know, they occupy probably the next highest proportion of the total violators. And you can deal with that by presence. You know, it's like a cop in the school zone. You see them there, you start to slow down. And then you don't see them for a while, and speeds start to creep up. So those folks that are on the fence, sustained presence helps. And again, I have to thank the additional resources from the Crab Endorsement Fund and Fish Program's willingness to share that for our ability to have some presence in an area that, frankly, we ignored a decade ago. I mean, we just didn't spend a lot of attention there. We were very focused on salmon, and we've become much more diverse since then. The hardcore They represent the smallest piece of the noncompliance picture, and those are the folks that lay in bed at night. They're planning how to rip off the resource. They've got special little holds in order to secrete their crab. Those are the folks we really like to catch, and we're pretty darn hard on them. We seize a number of vessels for forfeiture proceedings if the violation is particularly egregious and if they've gone to that kind of effort to try to beat the man. And so we make it worth our while, and we try to not make it worth theirs. You'll remember I spoke a little bit about the foreign fishing problem in our waters and how it can contribute to derelict gear. It also contributes to a lot of crab theft. And where the hardcore are concerned, you know, the greatest deterrence is a dang good penalty. You know, you whack them hard. And we can only do so much. The prosecutor has a responsibility as well. The judge has a responsibility to provide for some meaningful penalties. And I received some news the other day that a couple of Canadian vessels that had been fishing illegally in the U.S., those cases had been adjudicated. So I'll just read quickly from this. One individual, there was combined fines of $25,000, two different vessels, and a suspension of suspension from the crab fishing industry for 10 years, two individuals. One of these persons had been caught three times. So our officers in North Sound were a part of this case, our partners in DFO, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, their law enforcement branch. They're fantastic to work with, and so is Border Patrol. It's amazing how many agencies are actually watching that border, not just for the terrorist and the load of drugs that are coming across. They're also watching that border for illegal incursions into our waterways. Our folks have done a good job educating them with respect to why this is important. And I can remember years where we hauled 1,000 crab pots in a day that were fishing illegally in our waters.
Before you start, Rich, Commissioner Perry has a question.
I just wondered if can Canadians buy a Washington license to fish here legally?
No, not as a non-citizen.
I see.
Commissioner Carpenter?
I'm sorry. Did you mean commercial or recreational, sir?
I hadn't even thought about it that much. Either one. I suppose the recreation or the commercial is closed, so they couldn't buy one of those. But
Well, if there were an open commercial fishery in the U.S. and they were a Canadian citizen, they would not be able to participate. However, yes, they can buy. We'll sell them a recreational license.
Okay.
And we'll sell them a boat too.
And we'll sell them a boat.
So to kind of try to sum this up and wrap it up. So there were recreational fishery openings 5 days a week in all regions or marine areas of Puget Sound July 1 through Labor Day, or some areas July 15th through September 30th. Winter recreational openings occurred in all regions except regions 4 and 6, as I stated earlier, because the state share was taken during the summer fishery. Commercial fishery openings occurred in regions 1, 2, and 3 as directed in the policy, so there was adequate crab to provide a commercial fishery in those regions. We did have an extensive partnership with angler groups and non-government organizations for an extensive crab education and outreach program that we're going to continue, modify as we learn, as you know, we go through 2013, 14, and so forth. Overall, the regulation compliance in the recreational fishery is what I think we could say is good. Always could be improved, except for the immediate recording of a crab on a catch cart. We've got some room to improve there, as well as we'd like to get that return rate above 70% as well. Close-season gear removal, emphasis patrols, and that partnership between enforcement and fish program is very successful at removing large numbers of derelict pots. And as Mike stated, that's that proactive approach. We're actually getting them out of the water before they actually become derelict gear, and we're going to continue that in 2013. And we can open it up for questions.
Commissioner Smith was first.
I had the opportunity last year and the year before to go out with Deputy Chief. Well, last year was the first time with Deputy Chief. And I just wanted to say, for the record, what an outstanding representative you are to the state and the department. A lot of what I witnessed in my time with you is diplomacy. And you are a great spokesman. And the interaction with the recreational users out there, You did much more education than I thought of before I went out. So I just wanted to say I was very impressed by your demeanor the whole day and the other two officers on the boat. It was a long day, and we checked a lot of people. And so.
Thank you. Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Rich, did you notice any abnormal behavior in the commercial side where people financially stressed? Is there any leases for sale? Any feedback from the success of the commercial side, from the business side?
You know, I haven't noticed any real change. I think they were, as a group, kind of prepared for big, you know, drastic changes in their fishery, and that in terms of like the opening of what pot limits they chose and then how we adjusted their pot limits throughout the season was kind of a status quo from the last 5 years or so. So I think that price increase that coincided at the same time that the policy was revised, and you know, basically they're still riding that high abundance, so their catch rates are up as well as the price. So kind of status quo.
Commissioner Jennings?
In the recreational only by policy areas, we had had provisions for commercial mop-up if there was any remaining allocation. Did that happen at all this year?
Yeah, and that is a provision in the Puget Sound shrimp policy.
Oh,
not in the
crab
policy.
Okay. Too many policies.
Wouldn't be needed in these areas. The recreational group's pretty successful at tagging their target.
When I look at the catch record card return rate or compliance rate of 50%, 53%, with a $10 charge if you fail to do so, seems like that $10 charge is not all that big an incentive. And so I'm kind of wondering, how else might we get their attention? And so if you didn't turn in your catch record last year, should we allow you to have a catch record this year as an example of a different approach rather than financial? And the reason I bring it up is this is a fishery that's a tribal, non-tribal fishery. So we really have to have good numbers about what we're catching so that we can make sure we're staying within our side of the allocation. Without the catch record cards, or with the catch record card return rate of 53%, how precise are we, how comfortable are we with our estimates of total harvest on the recreational side?
Yeah, Commissioner Jennings, the fail to record piece, that 10, 12, 15%, as well as is from a co-management perspective, and you mentioned accurate numbers, that is our biggest challenge with the tribes, because we share this information with the tribes, and they're seeing that number and saying, well, you know, clearly you're not getting all your crab recorded, so even if you got 100% of these cards back, you're not getting fully accurate numbers. So the last couple of years, the discussions have been very heated
towards having an adjustment factor in the recreational fishery, and I have strongly advocated to not go that route, that we should be working together as co-managers to correct the problem rather than fix it. Those discussions are still continuing, but the piece, that 50% or so that aren't returning, we have very good information from a few years of doing telephone surveys of the group that failed to return. So we have a very nice correction factor that we basically take all the return cards, enter them into a computer, and consider it census data, and then expand that number to account for those that fail to return. The final piece that you mentioned is that incentive to return, that $10 penalty. Back when we were originally discussing having a penalty in place, the advisory group was advocating for if you don't return, you don't get a license the next year. And we kind of had those discussions and so forth, and realized, you know, it would be very, very difficult to get legislation passed that would deny a citizen a catch card or so forth.
So it couldn't be a WAC. It would have to be a RCW.
It's an RCW. So then the discussions went to, well, how about $50 for fail to return? And that seemed too high. So when we went to the legislature for this penalty, we asked for $20. And they granted us 10, the ability for 10. Now, this exact same discussion came up yesterday at the advisory group meeting, and there's discussions, let's go back to the legislature now and say, okay, we've got a number of years of $10, and it's clearly not getting us to our goal, and ask for the $20 or $25 penalty again. And that may be something that may go forward next year.
Okay. So I held my questions until the end. Other people sort of jumped in. In 4 and 6, we went over the state-level allocation, and those are both the rec-only sites, I think you said.
Mm-hmm.
And so you let I wasn't sure what you said about you let the tribes come in and catch up with us? Or, I mean, if we've gone over our portion, how do we let them have – how does that work?
Yeah, for instance, in Region 4, Marine Area 10, we had an initial state and treaty share of 100,000 pounds each, so 100,000 pounds share. Those are what we call initial harvest targets or initial quotas, and there's provisions in the management agreements to adjust those in season up or down based on the performance of the fishery. So when we got our catch record card numbers for that region, the recreational fishery had caught 145,000, something like that. And so obviously we've taken our full share.
Our share was 100,000?
100,000.
Okay.
Right.
Not half of 100,000.
Right. So it was 100,000. Right.
Almost 50% over.
Right. So we met with the tribes and said, okay, we are over, we're done. There's still many months left on the fishery. And what we did is we increased the quota by 20,000. The tribes went out and caught 20,000, collected some catch rate data, said there's still a lot of crabs, so we added another 20,000. And so basically we, in effect, increased the quota for both the tribes and the share so that they fished up to parity with the state.
So when we passed the regulation that was currently in place, one of my concerns was 5 days, five crabs, especially in the areas close to large urban areas, which may get a lot of pressure. And so this sort of says to me that, at least based on 1 year's data, I wasn't too off base with my concerns about so many people, 5 days, five crabs, we went over by 50%. So I'm just saying that out loud because I think if we see this trend in those areas, we might have to look at how are we, is that a realistic rate of harvest for recs if we continually to exceed our quota? This is a statement.
Yes.
You did sort of touch on already the compliance rate versus the harvest estimate. You're comfortable with your statistical analysis based on census and the total number and the work you've done that, in fact, based on the numbers you get, we can get pretty close to our actual estimate.
Yes, that's correct.
You talked about mailing cards out early, you know, the pamphlet out, and then the reminder. Have you thought about, have we looked at, do we have email addresses for a lot of these? Would that save us money? I know in other state agencies, when we have done postcard mailings, which are effective, but they're also labor-intensive and expensive relative to electronic contacts. And so has there even been a discussion about, can we afford that? Does that make sense to continue doing the postcards? Are there other sort of electronic options that may supplement that to bring the cost down, or just putting that out there for consideration?
Yes, and we have had that discussion, and we continue to. Should we be looking at cross, and maybe this is a year to look at that, cross-referencing the addresses? Do we have a current email address as well as a physical, and then maybe emailing? And that's something, I think that's kind of, as you indicated, that's kind of what we're looking at in the future. Something else that is on the works right now, and Deputy Chief reminded me of it, is I've been contacted by some graduate students at the University of Washington that are very avid crabbers, and they are wanting to, just for the fun of it, basically, they're developing a app for smartphones for reporting, and they want to come and talk to us about how, you know, is there a way maybe we could provide that as a real-time sort of way to report your crab rather than these catch cards? And they're very familiar with just talking to them on the phone with our whole system and so forth. And they're just saying, you know, that is very old school, what you guys are doing,
right?
You know, basically. So I thought that was very interesting, and I said, send me an email with what you guys are thinking, and we'll work with you and kind of discuss this.
And then my last question is, recovered pots. Picked them up on the, I guess you're going out on Tuesdays and Wednesdays and collecting pots from the water that shouldn't be there. Is that?
Thank you, Commissioner Jennings, and post-season, so when the season's completely over.
So what happens to them? Do you contact the owner and then send them a fine for being out of compliance? Do you seize the gear and sell it off? What do we do?
Do a number of things, almost all of the things that you mentioned. They could be forfeited to the state. I'm thinking about I'm reminding myself of current legislation. If we notify them and they don't contact us, it becomes abandoned gear. And then, yes, we can auction it off. Some of this gear isn't in very good shape, and so we just make one big crab pot out of it, and it goes to the dump. But some does go to auction, and then those proceeds go into the 07V reward account. Some owners are contacted and either warned with an officer on their stoop, or they may be contacted over the phone and warned. It depends on how busy the officers are, how much gear they're dealing with, whether you can identify the owner in the first place. Oftentimes, a lot of this stuff is not properly marked, right, and it's real challenging. So we use a variety of techniques.
Thank you.
Commissioner Perry.
Thank you. This is maybe a more biological question. I keep thinking about the volume of crab removed. And do you have areas that are real popular that, you know, people fish a lot, take a huge amount of crab out of? Do they tend to be less productive the following year?
You would think so.
Well,
you know what? It's kind of a head scratcher on this one, because we have some areas. Let's take Hood Canal and Port Townsend Bay. Those are two very, very popular recreational crabbing sites. And you see phenomenal catch rates that will happen throughout the summer, and it really does drop off in the winter. And if we go out and do test fisheries, for instance, in March or so, you won't see hardly any legal-sized crab left in the system. And then you go back in late May, and all of a sudden here's all of these, really, particularly in the Port Townsend area. I use an example. There's phenomenal numbers of these large, big male crab that show up that we really cannot figure out where they come from.
Hood Canal, more of a closed system in there. One thing we did do a few years ago of interest, we've always wondered, you know, in those deep areas in Hood Canal, 400 feet or so, are there crab all the way across? And we actually set gear all the way across Hood Canal in every depth, and there was crab everywhere we set gear in Hood Canal. So what we can infer what's happening is we have a lot of 4.5-5-inch male crab in the system that aren't being taken, and that is one molt away from being of the legal size, because they'll grow an inch to an inch and a half on one molt. And then they do that mass molt right now, this time of year, April, May time period, and that's the new cohort that's going to be fished that next year.
Just one other question, and I'll keep quiet on this, but do crab have any competitors for their habitat that they use, or do they even have a specific habitat that they tend to use rather than some other areas on the bottom?
Well, their favorite habitat, of course, is what most of Puget Sound is, kind of that sandy mud bottom area. They're not found in rocky areas, particularly because the females, when they're brooding eggs, like to bury in the sand mud area. So their competitors mainly are red rock crab, but that's a pretty small competitor. So no real competition for habitat. They're kind of the king of that sand mud flat area.
I see. Thank you.
Commissioner Mencken?
I hope we're done asking questions, so I'd like to compliment you on your stellar performance again. Very rich in data, very innovative for the two of you, and Rich, I think you and your staff have done a stellar job. Thank you.
We're not done yet. Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the last one because she gave me the snake eye. up in my neck of the woods, up in Area 7, there is a very large growth pattern on epithelial snow crab. And I saw some test pots, pictures of test pots that were full, top load pots. Don't need to go into that opportunity. That might be in our future. But, Deputy Chief, I had a recently retired commercial crabber in my store a couple of weeks ago, and he'd been up in Blaine. And what was happening in Blaine, allegedly, the commercial crabbers up there were getting epithelial crab in, so I'm told that if there are epithelial crab in a Dungeness pot, the Dungeness crab will not come in. The commercial crabbers were allegedly having 55-gallon barrels and pots and things on their boat. They were throwing the epithelial crab in, fill it with water, and dumping bleach in them to kill them and dump them back overboard. I referred that immediately to Officer Downs. Did you hear anything about that?
Thank you, Commissioner Carpenter. Not with respect to the addition of bleach, but I know that they made several cases where fishermen had possession of those crab on board their vessel and they were pinched. So I didn't hear anything with respect to whether they were trying to kill them, but they'd reduced them to possession without a permit from the director and a closed commercial fishery for that species, so they were cited.
When the gentleman was in my office, I put him on the phone with Officer Downs. This fellow was quite knowledgeable. I just thought it was worth communicating. So.
Thank you, sir.
Could you just summarize for me what the enforcement outlook is for the commercial fishery? We've talked a lot about compliance in the sports side. How are we doing on the commercial side?
Without citing any numbers, it's a smaller pool of people, easier to track. We did make several cases in Puget Sound last season with respect to commercial fishers, and we made some close season cases as well. They're neither recreational fishermen nor commercial license holders, but they poach crab for the marketplace. And we've also made some tribal cases as well. I won't go into specifics now, but you know the market for closed season and undersized crab is red hot.
Okay.
It's red hot.
Okay. We've gone way over because you're both so interesting to listen to. and it's such an important fishery. So thanks again. Really commend you for the collaborative spirit of your efforts together. That's what we definitely like to see. So we'll see you next year for the...
Well, not before.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rich?
All right, we're ready to go into recess until 8:30 tomorrow morning. We do have a big tent committee meeting tonight at Bed Bay in just 1/2 hour. Cool. So the rest of you have a good evening, and we'll see you tomorrow morning.